Blog Talk Radio.
For joining us on the Wise Women Media, the radio show, another installment of our every Friday night show, honoring women that are changing the world. That was Alicia Keys and her new song, We Are Here. Absolutely stunning lyrics on that. And I want to just make a few announcements. Check us out at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. You can see all our archived shows there. You can see a list of our sponsors. We want to give a shout-out to Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio, which gives us this time slot every week. Also, we are independent media, so don't forget to fund us. And on wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com, you'll see the GoFundMe link. Just hit us up. No amount is too small to help us stay on the air. You can find us on Twitter, Wise Women Media, on Tumblr, again, Wise Women Media. We have a Facebook group, and we also have a Facebook page. So let me see if there was one. Oh, one other thing, of course, is next week we will not be on the air because I plan on being at the Climate Change March in New York City. So hopefully I'll have lots of information to report on for our show on the following Friday, which would be, I believe, the 26th. I hope I have that date right, but it'll be the Friday after next week. So without further ado, I believe Sherry Roberts, our special guest, is on with us right now. So let me click in. Sherry, is that you?
I'm here, Anita. How are you doing tonight?
Good. I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Finally happy to be done with that story.
Yeah, well, thanks for agreeing to be on the show. You've been on the show before when we did a special broadcast after Michael Rupert's untimely demise, and we got on the air with Carolyn Baker as well. It was a great show. But tell us a little bit about what's been happening since then and some of your projects, and then we can get on with talking about that story you just finished up.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me again, Anita. I really appreciate it. I like doing stuff with you. It's always fun. Well, let's recap the Mike Rupert story a little bit. As your listeners know, I inadvertently became the reporter of note on that story, which was very overwhelming for me. It was probably one of the biggest stories I've ever written on as far as, like, attention from people and media people as well. And I'm still dealing with a lot of stuff with, you know, from that story. I have people contacting me all the time, still with questions and stuff. So that's been interesting. And, you know, actually I just recently saw a post yesterday or the day before. Oh, no, it was yesterday. I had a lot of hits yesterday on the Rupert story simply because it was the anniversary of 9/11. And it was being reposted, and several people were, you know, saying that I did Mike proud, and I really hope that I did. You know, I know there's some people that disagree with some of the stuff that I wrote, especially when it came to mental illness issues, but, you know, we're all supposed to be telling the truth, and, you know, even if we're, you know, from an alternative viewpoint on things, if we're whitewashing, you know, our own stories, then, you know, we're not real truth tellers, then are we, right?
Exactly. And there was no reason to whitewash that story. The facts were out, and I was amazed at how many people were behind the scenes really trying to change it up and make their own story out of it. And as you and I both know, that was not true, that it was a conspiracy theory, you know,
Go ahead.
No, we knew that was not true. So, and what you were getting at was the facts, that was the most important thing. And the facts is you knew them from the people that were closest to him, which I think was the most important.
As well as my own experiences with him. I've taken a lot of flack. You know, there are people that want to believe there's a conspiracy there. And again, there are some people that were close to Mike that knew full well what was going on with Mike. However, they would have preferred that the mental health issues weren't discussed in a public forum. But I think in understanding Mike Rupert as a human being, which, you know, he was, it was important to know the whole story and to have all those facts so that it made a lot of sense because, you know, Rupert really had many different audiences from the past to the middle ground, to the present. And a lot of those audiences really never crossed paths, so they only knew Mike how they knew him. And that's where a lot of disbelief would come in, you know, over his suicide. So, you know, that was very enlightening for me. That was a huge learning curve in writing that and dealing with some of the stuff I dealt with and dealing with coroners and stuff like that. I learned a lot. And, you know, I think that there's a symbiosis to things that happen. I think that there was a reason that I ended up being the one writing the stories. And I, you know, again, another way that Mike was teaching me a lesson about being a journalist. So, you know, forever indebted. So on that note,
I wanted to remind people that this is a call-in show, and if you all have any questions for Sherry, just give us a call at 213-816-0357. I was able to get the chat room open, so it is operational. And if you're looking at the player and you don't see the chat room when you scroll down, just refresh your screen, and it should pop in there. And if it doesn't, and you want to ask a question, but you don't want to get on the air, then go to our Facebook page, facebook.com, Wise Women Media, and you can post your questions there, and I will read them on the air. So there's quite a few options there. We do prefer the calls. They seem to help us flow a little quicker through some of these facts. So what have you been doing? What other special projects besides this big story have you been doing since our last broadcast?
Oh, several things. I was working on stories in relation to the Santa Barbara Isla Vista killings from Elliot Roger. In my home, I had one of his childhood friends that was mentioned repeatedly in the so-called manifesto that Elliot Roger left behind, 137-page manifesto, which is really just a biography piece when all is said and done. Anyways, Phil Bloser was a friend since elementary school, and, you know, him and his family and other people that were mentioned in this manifesto were thrust into the ugly limelight of the aftermath of what had happened. And, of course, these people were all hounded by media. I simply reached out to Phil, you know, just to kind of warn him about that this was going to happen as far as, you know, the media bombarding him, and which mm-hmm. was the case. He actually came up to my home and spent a day with me, and we did a lot of audio interviews. I've written a couple pieces on it already. We'll probably be getting together again soon. But so that was another big story, and another one that had, you know, a lot of heinous details to it. You know, nobody really wants to, you know, experience, you know, that sort of stuff. But it is what it is in today's world, and, you know, so we talk about it, and that's how we move forward and heal. So that's one of the other big things I've been doing. Right now, you know, as you know, I've just written this piece with regards to the jails in the United States, particularly in California, although it's across the board. So that's a project I'm working on. And then, of course, there's the project you and I are working on together, which is the Challenging the Rhetoric, which is going to be killer. I can't wait for that to launch on October 1st.
So we'll cover Challenging the Rhetoric first, and then we can go on to the details of your story, your latest story about the prison system and detention centers. But Challenging the Rhetoric was something that I envisioned after I was watching McCain talk probably about 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago about, and then it was topped off with Biden talking about how we're going to go kill them all, and McCain was using the same rhetoric. Let's go kill them all. Let's get rid of the Islamic State. And, of course, we know the people that have been following the news pretty closely, like yourself, Sherry, and like me, were, you know, I'm seeing pictures of him, like, you know, hanging out with these Islamic State. And then I'm hearing things that Islamic State is really just mercenaries and contractors. And then, lo and behold, I go and do a search and find a whole website about a defense contractor stationed out in Arizona, I think is their corporate headquarters, called ISIS. And it looks like they can do all the same things that the, you know, Islamic State can do. So I'm thinking this is a lot of rhetoric, and it may not even be true, and it may not even be how it's presented through the media. And
right.
And it was just driving me nuts. And then somebody else handed me a picture of some of these Islamic State people with tattoos. And everybody knows that, you know, if you're following the Quran or you're following the Torah, you don't tattoo your body. So
right.
They found that pretty unusual. And it looked like something a military, an American military person would have on their arm, not somebody from the Islamic State, quote unquote.
Or a Blackwater contractor. You know, we have similar things when the news of Osama bin Laden's death, and then again with Saddam Hussein's death. And you know, I mean, a lot of the details of this when we see the pictures or the different, you know, things that they do for these deaths, you know, the burial at sea for bin Laden. I mean, those are not typical. Those are not something that you would see in Islam, you know, ceremonies and stuff. So, you know, when we hear this stuff, people like you and I, Anita, we live and breathe what's happening in the world today. Unfortunately, we're the minority in that. And so the people that don't do what we do, that don't pay the kind of attention that we pay, they go along their lives until something literally reaches out and just shoves them up against the wall and says, hey, you need to deal with this. And so all those little things, like the tattoos that you mentioned in the images, they don't even see those. All they see is the same thing, just like with 9/11. You know, we saw what they told us we were seeing, not what was actually in front of our eyes.
Right, right, exactly. So with all this rhetoric going on, I thought to myself, as I'm envisioning what we can do, is why don't we take the top stories, the ones with all the rhetoric, and find ways to challenge them in the written, especially in the written word. But, you know, I'm not going to rule out video. I'm not going to rule out radio. I was watching also another person that kind of inspired me was Russell Brand, because it looks like he's already started doing something like this, and everybody kind of poo-poos him as kind of like this ridiculous actor slash comedian who doesn't make any sense. Well, when you watch his videos with the Trews News, TREWS, that's exactly what he's doing. He's challenging the rhetoric. He's hearing
right.
the rhetoric, and then he's responding to it. And apparently Fox News got really mad at him about a week and a half ago, and they were really chomping at the bit to tear him to pieces on some of their news programs. And he got him below the belt where it hurt, because he challenged the rhetoric. So I thought, this can be easily done. So within, a week, you and I had talked, and then we have the website up, we have the social networks up, and we're hoping for an October 1st launch with independent media stories coming from everywhere. And then we can expand on that, of course. But we want it to be challenging the rhetoric kind of stories. This is what we're hearing, but this is what really is the truth. And,
and
Naomi Wolf has been doing a lot of this on her Facebook page, too.
Yes, she has. She has.
Yeah, she's been really an amazing person to watch through this whole Israel-Gaza conflict. She seems to have really put the screws to a lot of the rhetoric that came out during that time. So got to admire her for that. Do you have your viewpoint on how this all began? Because once you and I started chatting about this, it kind of exploded.
I warned you, I work fast. You know, when you were telling me your concept and everything, I definitely see a need for it. And to bounce off what you just said about Russell Brand, you know, we have to think about Russell Brand being the comedian that he is, and, you know, and the stuff that the type of shows that he's done, the different media coverage he's gotten before he really got real political, just, you know, for drunkenness or whatever. And people form these opinions. But, you know, they've done the same thing with people like Johnny Depp, who, you know, come across a lot more believable, but as soon as there's something negative or whatever. Charlie Sheen, you know, all these people that are speaking truths and stuff like that, they're still lambasted. They're going to find anything. People do it to me. I'm no superstar, but, you know, people find reasons to hate me as well. And, you know, and you know, you've been through it, Anita. So, I mean, you know, basically, I pick and choose who I, you know, like I might use something Russell Brown's doing or saying for a certain audience, but I know it's not going to go over well with this other audience. So I'm very, I very much pick and choose how I present things to different people, you know, so that they can digest it better. You know, it's all about digestion. It's all about how people can consume the information that we give them and then digest it. You know, we all order eggs differently when we go out to breakfast. It's because we like them differently and we can digest them differently. So information's the same. Now, as far as back to your concept with challenging the rhetoric, I see a need for this. I love the idea, you know, that we're doing this project all female, you know, from tech to everything, from tech on up. You know, the hope is that we could do this without any masculine help. So, you know, that's fantastic. I took your concept and I started putting together some visuals and like, okay, you know, we can do this, do that. And at the same time, I started soliciting different people I'm connected to that are real journalists out there. And we have a few that are coming on board I'm really, really excited about. And I know that as these voices are being heard after the launch, more people are certain, more women are most definitely going to want to get involved. But Linda Milazzo is going to be doing some stuff with us. We have Laurel Wiley is going to be doing some stuff with us. Christine Coates is going to be doing some stuff with us. You know, I mean, there's just a lot. So from, you know, weekly columns to all sorts of stuff. And rhetoric, people don't necessarily understand the word. They hear the word, they use the word all the time. And really what rhetoric boils down to is how we present something and the emphaticness with which we present it, the emotion that we use to present it. And as we know in corporate media, we deal often with overemphasis on the things that do not matter, overemphasis on things that are a distraction from the things that do matter. So basically, your concept is a dissection job, and I love it. So I'm really, really happy to be a part of it.
I see it being done, but in a minor way, you know, through other news, independent news outlets, and I really want to, you know, really watch the news and say, okay, what are 10 points that I'm hearing this week over and over again that are
right.
just not... It's like they're being these things, these ideas or these so-called facts, which we know aren't facts at all, are pounded into us. And it's that same old theory that if you repeat a lie often enough, people will believe it, you know, and that's where we're at with that.
You know, that is true, but you have to, coming from 20 years in corporate media, what I can tell you about that is frequency sells. So it's not just about repeating a lie and getting people to just finally, you know, cow to it. It is really, truly marketing. And, you know, there's this thing, frequency sells in media, whether it's imprints from television and billboards or whether it's, you know, how many times somebody's heard a message, you know, in a podcast or on a radio station or whatever. And like in broadcast media, it's called a frequency of three. And usually, basically, when you're out there selling, you know, you're selling airtime or whatever, you're talking, you're trying to get a schedule out of your clients, you're like, no, we need to repeat it over and over, consistency, right? Consistency is important if you're trying to get new customers and stuff like that. But in essence, what these corporate media people are doing is they're trying to retain customers that they have, which is their viewers, and they're trying
right.
to get new ones. And so they are selling something. They're selling lies, but they're doing it from a marketing sales perspective, and it works. It absolutely works. I mean, we saw this with the White House Iraqi group after 9/11. It was the White House Iraqi group that was the marketing arm of the White House that sold the American people as they were all freaked out and fervently waving their flags after 9/11 to, you know, cow to the government, you know, line of this is what we're going to do and this is what needs to happen and because they're going to kill us. you know. And so when things are repeated over and over and over, it's marketing, plain and simple. And there are millions and millions of dollars spent every year on studies from all the different media corporations combined. And they're always trying to learn different ways, not just for their advertisers, but for themselves as a brand as well and their information. A lot of people don't realize that.
Huh. Well, you know, what was really funny was all during that crazy week where everybody was like, you know, let's bomb them, let's bomb them. I think I saw Judge Jeanine on Fox News. She must have said that like five times. We must bomb them. Bomb them all.
Right.
Bomb them. And
right,
I'm going, oh, my God. And then I saw Biden do his shtick, and then it was McCain, and I'm going, oh, my God, everybody wants to bomb everybody. And it was just repeated. And it didn't matter. I just kept flipping the channel. I kept going from, like, Fox to CNN to ABC to CBS. And it was all the same. And I'm going,
yeah.
Oh, my God. And
yeah,
they're
crazy.
All in on it. I felt like I was surrounded by these crazy militaristic nutcases. You know, they were in my head. And I thought, this
you
is
were.
In my head. And I'm going, we have to challenge this. This is just crazy talk, you know?
Right.
So anyway, that is how challenging the rhetoric was born, and you know, we hope to get that started soon. We've guesstimated an October 1st launch, so anybody that's listening to this show right now is going to hear more about it. Anybody that's connected with Cherie and I on Facebook anywhere, we also already have a page, Challenging the Rhetoric. We're on Twitter with rhetoric versus facts. That's rhetoric vs facts would be the hashtag. And we have a website, and we're ready to go. So
yeah, challengingtherhetoric.com.
Yeah, challengingtherhetoric.com. So let's move on from that, and then we'll go to the status of the prisons and detention centers. And I know your article is probably pretty specific to California, but I can assure you with everything that I know, it's probably pretty similar here in Florida and lots of other states too. So what do you know?
Yeah.
Tell us.
Well, first of all, my confession is yes, I went to jail. I spent 2.5 weeks in a county jail here in California in San Bernardino County at the West Valley Detention Center. And for anyone wondering, I had a very old DUI warrant. I didn't realize it was a warrant. I had paid a $1,700 fine many years ago, took a class. Apparently it was the wrong class. Anyway, so I get picked up on this warrant. Now, I've never been to jail before in my life other than when I got the DUI and I was there for a few hours. And so, you know, it was total culture shock for me, you know. And I'm a really strong person, and I'm pretty fearless most of the time, but, you know, I won't lie. I was scared, you know. I was like, I didn't know if somebody was going to, you know, try to make me their bitch or what, you know. And so, you know, all I had anything to base off of is stories I've heard or shows I've seen or whatever. And, you know, we have all the police brutality and stuff that's just almost daily, if not hourly, in the news as of late particularly. And so, you know, I know that there's bad cops out there. Not all of them are bad, but there's certainly a lot of bad ones. And since 9/11, the militarization of our law enforcement is outrageous. And the mentality that has grown behind that is wholly unacceptable. So upon entering this detention center, you know, they give you a ratty little mattress pad and, you know, what they call a fish kit, which has an ounce or two of toothpaste and a tiny little toothbrush that all the bristles fall out when you use it, and little floppy comb that, you know, you try to brush your hair and all the teeth come out of the comb, you know. So, I mean, it's real minimal. So I'm walking in there, and the way these units are is they're called pods, and there's 8 slivers in the pod there. And so I go into my unit in the pod where they sent me. I don't know what to expect. So, and the way they had it is, you know, it's a 22-hour lockdown facility. So at face value, you're supposed to be locked into your cell for 22 hours of the day. You come out twice a day for an hour for day room time. That's not counting your meals, the three meals that they serve a day, which we'll get into in a minute. You come out, you're expected to eat very rapidly if you eat at all, and then right back to your cell for lockdown. Lock it down, girls, lock it down, girls, is probably the phrase I heard more than anything during my time there. So I go in, and, of course, right away there's one particular woman who, she's got her eye on me, and I just knew this was going to be a problem. But, you know, I'm holding my own. I got my head held up. I'm not going to show any fear. I get into my cell. I lock it down, and I'm just sitting there by, you know, trying to figure out what it is I'm going to do. You know, why am I here? Why is this happening to me? And all of that. I went in there with the wrong mentality of thinking, oh, this is going to get fixed. I'm going to be out of here in no time. You know, this is a mistake, blah, blah, blah. But let me tell you something. Once you're in these places, it's really hard to get out of them. I didn't even get to make a phone call for 5 days. Now, you know, we were raised to learn if you get arrested, you get a phone call right away. That's not the case. It was 5 whole days before I was able to make a call. There's just a lot of things that I started seeing, but once I realized I was there until they said I could go, I had to really change my mind about things. And in order for me to not, like, flip out and get all crazy, I had to, like, focus on what I was seeing and what I was hearing. The stories the girls were telling me that was corroborating stuff that I was seeing with my own eyes, experiences I was having there. And I'm like, you know what? I'm here for a reason, apparently, other than to, you know, take care of this old warrant. But I need to write about this. This is current news right now, but we're only talking about the brutality that's happening on the streets. We're not talking about the brutality and the negligence and everything that's happening behind bars. And, yes, people are there. They've done a crime. But it does not mean that they should have to withstand some of the stuff that's going on.
Wow. So this was a real wide eye-opener.
tell me about it. Yeah.
So
yeah, I don't belong in jail.
How did you get there?
Basically, you know, I went in there, and so here's how it went. I go in there, I'm in my cell, and the first thing that I start noticing is there's drugs in jail. Okay, so I'm like, oh, okay, you know, and I was a little surprised, and so I started trying to pick and choose who I could talk to about it because I wanted to find out how these drugs were coming in. And I found out that there's a couple bail bonds places that were local to that vicinity that did a lot of business there, and they're passing dope. And, you know, when they're doing their visitations, you know, they're sliding it under their files and passing dope in. There's also women and men. Of course, I was in the women's side of the facility, but this facility houses both men and women. Some women actually get themselves arrested on purpose. There's a couple drugs, one of which is called Spice, that they are able to push up underneath their fingernails and come in with it, or put in their nostrils where it looks like a hard booger or something. And they're able to come into the jail with these, you know, because that bypasses the strip search and all of that. I mean, they're not going to see that. They're thinking it's just dirt or whatever. And so now, boom, there's drugs in there. Not counting pharmaceutical drugs that, you know, West Valley is a medical facility, which we'll get into the medical aspect of that because it's kind of comical, but not in a funny way. You know, some of the prisoners would get medication and they would sell that in there as well. And, you know, there's no money actually passing hands. It's all for commissary stuff because, you know, the prisons these days are not like they used to be. You know, back in the day, if somebody was in jail or in prison, family or friends could come and visit you and bring you food or bring you papers and pencils and envelopes and stamps and, you know, that sort of thing. That doesn't happen anymore. You are not allowed to have anything, at least at this facility, that you don't purchase through their commissary. So you need shampoo and stuff that goes through there. You want food that's not on their menu, then you get it from the commissary. You want, you know, anything that you want. You know, I actually had one of the inmates mail me a letter that I just received, and she had mailed me a stamped envelope because she wanted to be sure that I would write her back. The envelope never made it to me. You know, the mail is opened and you're not allowed to seal your mail when you have outgoing mail, and when you receive mail when you're in there, it's open. And the contents may or may not be in there, depending if it's something that they deem to be contraband. So anyway, so let me tell you, so I get into this facility, and I'm noticing is, like, there's drugs. But what I'm also noticing is that predominantly everybody I'm encountering is there for a drug offense. Now, there were young girls, really young girls, that it just broke my heart, young mommies, you know, who, you know, different baby daddies here and there, you know, just young mommies that are strung out on dope. Meth and heroin were the two main ones. And, you know, they come in there, so they're detoxing when they first get there for those first several days. They're miserable. They're sick. You know, they're put in an environment that is, you know, a weird place to come down, I suppose. You know, but the drug problem is really rampant. So they come in there, they come down, and the next thing they know, they're finding somewhere else to get dope while they're in. There's no rehabilitative things that are happening at West Valley Detention Center. There was one flyer for SAMHSA, which is an organization to help with rehabilitating, but it actually costs money. It's not part of the system. And it's the only flyer visible up on the glass there. These girls, and it's having the same on the men's side, when they come in for drug offenses, if they choose, instead of regular court, it's what's called drug court, they choose drug court, and they get through drug court and they're accepted for it, they are then put in a program after, you know, they're released. And it's drug testing all the time. I think, I could be wrong, but if I remember correctly, I believe it's drug testing every day for the first, like, several weeks, and then it goes to every week. But there's, like, not counseling behind it. It's just like, it's like being on probation. This drug court is in lieu of a probation type thing. So, there's no counseling for these people that are messed up on drugs. Now, what's ironic about this, Anita, is that San Bernardino County has no less than 10 drug task force, okay? That is their big thing in San Bernardino County, which is a very, very wide area. So the majority of the people in there for drug offenses are because that's what these cops are out there looking for. You know, they're you know, it's like a cattle call. It's crazy. The jails and prison systems, they get paid for every inmate that's in there. And the way they get paid is not just like a per head count. It's for different processes of the processing. So, for instance, when I was released and I got my receipt for money on the books, blah, 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 they actually charged me for intake. They charged me for a doctor's appointment I never had, for a copay. They charge you for the fish kit. They charge you for all this stuff. There's a girl there who, she's on average is spending $1,800 a month in there. Why would they ever want to let her go, right? So what they're doing is, it's serious. I saw the paperwork myself. You know, it's crazy because what they're doing is they get paid per person, yes, but they also get paid for each step of the process. So you come in and you're put in a holding cell, and while you're in that holding cell, you get the jail and stuff get X amount of money for intake. Okay, once you're processed and you're put into a cell, meaning you're bedded, they get another amount of money because they gave you a bed. Now, what West Valley's doing and the other ones in San Bernardino County, they're all been very over full, so they've been transferring inmates from detention center to detention center. Every time an inmate is transferred, that's more money that the facility gets. So when one is full and another one opens up beds, they'll transfer and shuffle some over there. They get more money, then they'll shuffle them back. So they're getting double and triple paid for the same inmate. It's
so
pretty
nuts. Basically like you can't even, excuse the French, you can't even fart without there being a charge for it. You know, lift your finger and there's a charge for it, basically. But somebody's getting paid. You know, these people are getting paid. And, of course, we all have heard about, you know, the jails and detention centers becoming privatized. So that means there's a charge for everything. And,
it's definitely a business.
Yeah, so they are making money on having the max amount of people incarcerated, And this is something that I've noticed even with traffic tickets and things like that when you get stopped in a sting. You know, how can we make the most money? You know, we can sit here and wait for people to drive by and speed by us, and you know, we can charge each one of them $150 or more for speeding, you know.
Yeah.
So this is the same thing. This is, instead of working something like your situation out in a courtroom or allowing you to see a judge so you could plead your case, and possibly provide documentation to show that you indeed thought it had been taken care of, you know, they, without any questions asked, you get put behind bars because they can make money on that.
Right, and they have, when you're arrested here in California, at least in San Bernardino County, when you are arrested, up until the time you're actually sentenced, you're still supposedly supposed to be considered innocent, okay? Sentencing is supposed to happen within 72 hours. Weekends don't count. Holidays don't count. Monday, typical Monday through Fridays. 72 hours, you got 3 days to be sentenced. If you're not sentenced, the charges are arraigned. I'm sorry. You get 3 days to be arraigned. If you don't get arraigned, then the charges are supposed to be dropped. Well, I was seeing a lot of this happening, Anita. What was going on is there were people that were brought in, prisoners brought in, much more serious things than a very, very old, not that getting a DUI is a good thing. I don't condone that, but it was many years ago. I don't even drive. I don't have a car. you know, there were people that were coming in with much more major current right now offenses that would be processed in through intake, given a bed, and then within 1, 2, 3 hours, released. And then a new person brought in and given that same bed. When they're at capacity and they can't do any transfers like at nighttime, what they do is they offer the prisoners that are in the holding cells what they call a boat, which is like this plastic canoe that sits on the filthy floor of the holding cell. And holding cells, let me just tell you, for anyone who's never been to jail, I hope you never do go, but the holding cells are the worst. The holding cells have feces and urine and vomit and, you know, and a bunch of people, you know, of all walks of life. And it's quite noisy and, you know, and all this, that, and the other. And so these people are offered these boats, and they get $100 when they're released. It goes in their trust. But they will make $100 for each night that they spend sleeping in this plastic boat on the floor in the holding cell. And now if they're paying the inmates $100 each for doing that, how much money are they making? You know, how much are they making off that inmate for them being there? And they're still not even in the bed. But it counts as a bed if they put them in a boat. So it really is a money scam from how they charge the inmates with the commissary stuff, with the, you know, like in my case, you know, a doctor's copay when I wasn't even allowed to see a doctor, which is one of my big battles with them. You know, so there was a lot of stuff. Now, that stuff is really minor compared to the other stuff I saw, but this was like the awakening that I was going through in those first initial days. And what really nailed home my situation to me, though, was when I had to go to court in Joshua Tree, California, which is about an hour and a half or so away from the detention center, because that's where I'd gotten my DUI. And so they transport you out there on a bus with a bunch of other prisoners, males in the back, females in the front. And so I was at West Valley Detention Center, and then I was taken to Joshua Tree Jail, and then I was there for 3 days, because if you have to go up to Joshua Tree, the bus don't come back for 3 days. Their jail, they got their own issues that I didn't write about there. There's some stuff going on there, too. But when they were bringing me back, let me talk about the judge out there. The drug and alcohol court judge is Judge Cortez in Joshua Tree, California. The man has to ride a bike to court. He has 2 DUIs himself. These are all over the media and reported. So that's a conflict of interest right there, okay? He should not be the drug and alcohol judge. He's definitely got a bone to pick with people. He's notoriously an asshole and was true to form while I was there with him. And so anyway, so they come on the third day. So the deputies come to transport whoever's going back to West Valley. And this one deputy, his name was Deputy Cassis, Michael Cassis. I don't mind saying these people's names. Deputy Cassis walked straight up to me. Okay, I'm in a line of people they brought out. He bypasses the first couple people, and he walks straight up to me like he knew me or something. Was a really good-looking guy, kind of looked like Superman, really buffed out, but a jerk. This guy had an attitude that was so visible to anybody and everybody. And he walks straight up to me, and he, like, just stands in front of me, like, to intimidate me or something. I'm just standing there quietly with my hands crossed in front of me like you're supposed to, you know. Not sure why he singled me out. But what happened was is when they transport you, they chain you to another inmate with waist chains. And then you have your outer wrist is chained to your hip at the chain, and your inner wrist is chained to their hip at the waist chain, and then they're done to you the same way. Well, I have kidney cancer in my left kidney, and I have stage 3 kidney failure in my right kidney, fairly recently diagnosed. I have been going through all of the pre-op stuff because they're going to be removing my kidney soon. So I've been doing all this pre-op stuff right before this happened, and I was in the middle of passing a stone, a kidney stone, and I was in a lot of pain, and I still hadn't been able to see a doctor. This deputy took the waist chain, and he had it so tight around me, I couldn't even take a breath hardly. And I asked him very nicely, you know, I saw his badge, and, you know, I said, Deputy Cassis, you know, would you please loosen it slightly? And I tried to explain briefly why. And he looked at me, he yelled at me, what did you say? And then he proceeded to tighten the chain two full lengths tighter. When he chained my hands to the other prisoner, who was a mental patient at that, he had me chained in such a way that I myself was chicken-winged, which means you're like elbow to elbow, if you think of how a chicken's wings when they're up behind them, and which is actually against the law. It's one of the things that is against the law is chicken-winging. So I was chicken-winged in this very odd position where I could not sit back. They put me in a protective custody cage of this bus. Now, mind you, I'm there for an old DUI warrant, okay? but yet I'm in protective custody. And so I'm in this very awkward position. My face is basically resting against this metal cage front, and the sun's beating in on me from the side. You have no way to hold yourself still, you know, on this bus or whatever. And it was miserable, and it was an hour and a half or longer ride. By the time I got back to West Valley Detention Center, I knew I was in trouble. I knew that this was not going to be good for me. And in order to mentally make it through, I just started borrowing pieces of paper from people because I had no money on the books yet for the commissary. They only give you two sheets of paper when you arrive. So I just started asking people. I let people know that, you know, that were in my unit, that I was a journalist. And let me tell you, they were more than happy to accommodate me. And, of course, everybody had a story to tell. You know, and, of course, you got to take some of these stories with a grain of salt. You know, you don't, because you don't know the people and stuff like that. You got to verify and corroborate. And so I did. And so I spent the next week and a half, you know, the last week and a half that I was there, really just taking notes and asking questions and delving into things. And then, of course, when I got out, I was able to do the real research and stuff. And what's going on there, Anita, is there is currently a federal investigation into West Valley Detention Center for abuse, torture, sodomy. There's other investigation that's just getting ready to start for inmates dying while in custody in the jail because they're being ignored and neglected. And I witnessed some of this with my own eyes, unrelated to the active class action lawsuits that are going on. And if any of the listeners don't know the difference between a regular lawsuit and class action lawsuit, class action lawsuits are when there's like multiple plaintiffs. And so these class action lawsuits is going, I know of at least one against West Valley Detention Center right now. And then the neighboring jail, which is Riverside County Jail, there's been an ongoing lawsuit for the last month or so that has just now reached class action status. And what's happening is that first and foremost, there's a whole bunch of people on the initial class action lawsuit that, and these are on the men's side. The men are being, there's deputies that are coming in and they're doing hazing rituals. And they're tasing inmates and they're slated to go and they wake them up and they're tasing them. Some of these deputies are taking a single inmate and putting him in a chair with three deputies surrounding them. And the allegations are such that all three deputies are putting tasers onto the inmate at the same time and to see how many seconds until he drops, passes out, whatever, how much he can take from three tasers at once. Just real heinous stuff is happening in there. And one of the women in my unit, she's been there for 2 years, and one of her previous cellmates recently was 4 months pregnant, started having cramping. There's little emergency buzzers in each cell, and you're told don't push these buzzers for anything unless it's a real emergency. But even when you push them, they don't respond. When a lot of people were pushing the buzzers about this woman, she started bleeding. Nothing was happening. They were, everybody was being ignored. Nobody was answering the medical buzzers. Finally, one of the deputies responded into the cell and was like, "Would you, stop pushing the buzzer?" And he's like, "Look, she's going to lose her baby. She's bleeding now, blah, blah, blah." And I tell her to lay down, and like, I already have her laying down, you're your own doctors and nurses in there, really, and this is supposed to be a medical facility. Long story short, Anita, this woman was in so much pain, she stood up, and she literally miscarried right there on the fetus dropped into the cellmate's hands. It's really horrible, the things that are happening there. The food there, Anita, is like, some people complain about silly things. And, one of the things I would say to people when they come to me, once they realize I was a journalist, they wanted to complain about everything. They complain about stuff. I'm like, look, we're not here to be pampered. It's not their job to make things all, cushy for us here. We're here to, pay our dues. And certain things, if the bed sucks and you have no pillow and it's cold and the lights are always on or whatever, okay, well, big deal, deal with it. But when it comes to being served meat that's four different colors, that's a problem. When it comes to being served instant mashed potatoes that has fruit flies embedded in it, that's a problem. When it comes to drinking water that's colored, that's a problem. When you have thick pieces of lead paint peeling and dropping on you from the ceiling, that's a problem. When you have the cell next to you flush their toilet and their feces comes up into your toilet in your cell, that's a problem. Those toilets and the sinks, which is your drinking fountain, are all one unit. So who wants to drink out of that, right? There were so many things that it was like, I couldn't believe that I was seeing these things. I was like going, this is like a whole other country in here. And here our presidents are invading all these other countries, bringing democracy, but what about our own, What about what's going on here? And it's just nuts. So there's one of the gentlemen on this massive class action lawsuit that's going on against West Valley that the feds are investigating. His claims are that in a matter of 5 years' time, he was tased at least 80 times by at least a dozen different deputies. Now, can you imagine? We hear about people getting tased and dying, and kidney failure and all sorts of things. And, these people are just having all this stuff done.
Now, is there a reason why they were tasing him, or?
No, initially in the lawsuit, the way things read is that, it's denial, denial, denial. Now a couple deputies have lost their job. The Sheriff McMahon is trying to say that, it's isolated. It was just a couple bad seeds. Of course, we see that that isn't the truth because it's not isolated. There's bad seeds in law enforcement all over the place. And again, I'm not bad-mouthing all cops. There's some good cops out there. The problem is that those good cops, in order to remain good cops, they need to start calling out those bad cops. They need to start weeding out their garden and saying, hey, this is not what we stand for. We talk as people that are anti-war, we talk often not in our name, not in our name. Well, these good cops out there, they need to be the same. They need to make sure that what's going on behind that badge is what's right. And, a lot of people will say, well, if you're in jail, you deserve to be this, you deserve to be that. Well, let me tell you something. It does not matter why you are in jail once you are in there. Everybody is treated equally badly. It doesn't matter. I mean, I was treated the same way as somebody who, armed robbery. I was treated the same way as a heroin addict. you know, totally jonesing out and having the jerks and the vomits and all of that. It makes no difference. Once you're in there, you're just a piece of crap. And so, you know, there are going to be people listening or that'll read the story and say, well, you know, you're in there, it's not supposed to be nice. Well, that's all true and stuff, but there's these laws, there's these things called standards, that are standards for inmates when you're in custody and incarcerated. And, you know, simple things like the lights are not supposed to be left on at intense levels. They're supposed to be reasonably dimmed. That doesn't happen. The lights are bright. You know, good luck trying to sleep without putting something over your face. You know, I used a wet washcloth, kept it still. But, you know, they... you know, the beds, okay, these little thin mattress pads that they give you, they're not supposed to be ripped up or anything. The three that were issued to me, because every time they move you around, you got to turn in your stuff and then they give you new stuff, they all of them were ripped up. Now, they run this video in the day room, right, talking about all these things. You know, you're not to have this, you're not to have that, which are all the things is what they're giving us. You know, it says very clearly, if you're not allowed, we will never issue a mattress that looks like this. I'm like, really? Mine looks 10 times worse. You know, so you don't know what's in them because you got countless people sleeping on these things, you know. There is, again, the food was just outrageous. I've had a lot of poor times in my life. I've had a lot of poor times in my life where I've had to eat things that were not my favorite. And, you know, when you're hungry, you're hungry. There was many, many days where the only thing that I would eat was the piece of fresh fruit because we would get apples or oranges occasionally. Or these little packets of peanut butter. And it was kind of crappy peanut butter and really, really thick, but it was in a sealed package, you know. So, you know, you kind of live off of an orange and apple and a little packet of peanut butter. And some of the stuff that they feed you is just, it's just outrageous. You don't even know what it is. Now, there are court cases all across the country, Anita, about food. Aramark, most people know Aramark when they go to a ball game or a hotel.
Right.
Aramark,
or office,
you know,
supplies.
Yeah,
it's
and
a huge company.
You know them exactly. And
well,
you,
oh yeah,
usually
definitely.
When you're not in jail and you're dealing with something with Aramark, it's usually something pretty good, you know, and they present it well and all of that. But Aramark has the most contracts with the jails across the country, and Aramark has tons of lawsuits against them for maggots in food, rotted food, you know, just all sorts of stuff. Food arrives, and it's thawed and has been sitting in hot trucks for hours, days, and it still gets served. This stuff still gets served. There was a woman, now this was prior to me being there, and I'm still trying to get all the rest of the information, but it's a legit story. West Valley was sued in the last couple of years by a woman who, there was maggots in the beans and in the rice that was served at West Valley, and she saved them for 4 months. In her cell. And when she got out, immediately, of course, went and, you know, did what she had to do, and she won a lawsuit. And this stuff is not just happening at West Valley. I mean, in the story that I wrote, I link stories in Ohio and, you know, all over the place. This stuff is happening all over. So it's not one or two bad seeds, Anita. This is a real problem. You know, we have organizations like Cop Block and Renegade Popo and, you know, out there that are, you know, calling out these injustices, the stuff that's happening out in the streets, but we don't really have a whole lot calling out what's going on behind those bars. And I just thought this is an opportunity where I need to tell this story.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think needs to be done now besides your story to basically make people aware of what's happening in there? What needs to happen next?
The same thing that needs to happen in all of the world, and particularly the United States, and that's we need to discover humanity again. You know, we are so far removed from embracing humanity. You know, it's an eye for an eye. It's a me world. And, you know, back to the song that you played at the opening. Thank you for playing that. It's kind of my new favorite song right now. I've never been a huge Alicia Keys fan, but what I like about this song is that the lyrics in the song are very profound, and it's probably the first time I've ever heard a social justice song that is going to go far because it's done in such a way that it plays well in mainstream. But what I liked about how she presented the lyrics of the song is that, you know, she talks about God and she talks about Israel. She's not siding with one or the other. She's bringing it all back down to that humanity level and what we've lost. And it really boils down to we are all people. I am not better than you. I am not better than somebody in Syria. I'm not better than somebody in China. I'm not better than somebody that's in jail. We are all human beings. We all pee. We all fart. We all poop. We all bleed. We all have needs. We all have wants. And when we do something wrong and you're in jail and stuff, that's fine. Do your time. But what the laws state for jail, for jail and prison and detention centers is that they are not to interfere with who you are as a person. The only punishment, your punishment when you go to jail is simply to have your rights taken from you and that you are locked up. That's it. None of this other bullshit that goes on in these jails is legal. That's the way it is. But people don't know that. You know, we are in a fear society, which I believe is all rooted back in 9/11, and that just bred and bred, and, you know, that whole snowball effect where it wasn't us just fearing, you know, some brown people in the Middle East, or fearing, you know, some black people because of Trayvon Martin, or fearing, you know, anthrax because, you know, there's some powder on the floor, or, you know, it's all about fear. And when they've done a great job. They have segregated us as people again. You know, we went through desegregation, but now we're segregated more than we ever were when it was just about blacks and whites. We are segregated on every conceivable level of being a human being, and that needs to change. And the only way that that is going to change is for people to start turning off those TVs, people to start interacting with one another again. We bury ourselves in technology, and that's all great. We're connected. You know, we talk to thousands of people every day. Oh, you know, big deal. But who are you talking to face-to-face? Who are you hugging? Who are you reaching out and saying, what can I do for you? Something's not right, or who are you giving a pat on the back to in real life? What are you involved in off of your keyboard? You know, I hate keyboard cowboys. You have to walk the walk. You can't just talk the talk. You can't bitch about the things that are wrong and think that you're doing something about it by sitting on your keyboard. I write all day long, but I get out there and I do things too, and people need to do that.
Yeah, they have to. They have to put their money where their mouth is. And it's real easy. You know, I can understand people sitting behind a keyboard if they're physically not able to do the things that they would like
right.
to do. But there's plenty of people that, you know, can't do it. And I think it's important that we don't pass judgment on people that can't do it for whatever the reason. Some people are raising families, they're working three jobs, they're in survival mode, and you know, but if everybody does a little something, then, you know, we can make this world a better place. That's for certain sure. And I think if everybody can do a little something, then that's all that we can expect from them. You know, I myself, I try to, in addition to a work schedule and being online, I try to go to a few big things a year, and I try to organize other things. And I'm definitely good with connecting people, like connecting
right.
somebody that might help somebody else. And I always, in my relationships with people, very good friends or just acquaintances, I can usually make those connections, which is very helpful for a lot of people. So I really, really try to do that. I'm very excited about being able to go to, I'm hoping to go to the Climate Change March, which this will probably be one of the biggest things I've ever done. So I'm very excited about being able to go. And they're expecting 200,000 people in New York City. I mean, that's a lot of people.
That's
so
big.
But your article now, you published it earlier today, am I right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Where can people find that?
They can find that right now. Initially, you can find it on my website, which is sherryspeak.com, C-H-E-R-I, speak.com. And I'm going to go ahead and submit it to Op-Ed News. I write for Rob Call from time to time. I haven't written for them in a while, just because it's a bigger audience and it's a bigger message. I have pretty good traffic on my website, which is really nice. I don't monetize my site. So I think that's, you know, if there's any ads on my site, it's just WordPress stuff that they do, has nothing to do with me. But, you know, I've got high traffic on my site. So it does get a lot of views and it gets a lot of shares. I get a lot of shares on my stuff. And then I spread it out from there. I've got a really wide reach for somebody who's basically a nobody. So, you know, but once I put it up on Op-Ed, and I'm sure Rob will probably take it, you know, I would fully expect it to be one of the ones that gets headlined and, you know, and go from there. I do plan on writing more. I networked with a couple of the people that have been in there for a long time. There's one woman in there who I won't mention her name right now, but she's actually an author. And many of your listeners may even know who she is. But she, you know, she's been in there for a couple of years. She's a really great lady, and she's, you know, wholly out of her element. Sadly, her husband is also there on the men's side of the facility, and, of course, their only interaction is via letters. But there's a lot going on with their case. I've been in communication with both of their attorneys, so I'm going to be following up with some of that. I'm also going to follow up with some other stuff. I want to tell you real quickly, though, I was trying really hard to take some samples of stuff out of the jail with me. Okay, so I wanted to take some water samples from the fountain down in the day room as well as the one in my cell. I wanted to take food samples, and I wanted to take some samples of the paint chips that were peeling because I used to be an interior designer, and I'm almost positive it's lead paint. And this prison is 25 years old, and I wouldn't think that they'd be using lead paint, but it really has the appearance and feel and texture of lead paint. Anyhow, every night, because I had no idea when they were going to release me, because what they do, you won't believe this crap, what they do when they do release you, they release you in the middle of the night, okay? They wake you up in the middle, like 3 o'clock in the morning, they wake you up, they process you out, and they spit you out in the street, and you start walking, because you're not allowed to sit there and wait for anyone. You got to go walking out in the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night as a woman, right?
It's
just like, and they're trying to cure a crime? Yeah, right. You know, not to mention I never got my clothes back. I had to come home wearing some stranger's clothes, men's clothes at that, because they were clean at least. But, you know, so, yeah, so there's that stuff going on. But with these samples, so every night at dinner, I would take a little bit of food from each food item, you know, on the tray. And I'd take it back up to my room with me, and I would wrap it in a piece of cellophane plastic that came off of like a peanut butter sandwich that I saved this piece of cellophane. And I'd break off tiny pieces of it and put, you know, food in it and twist it up and wrap it so I can get it as airtight as possible. And then the next morning, if I was still there, I'd throw it away so it wasn't rotten in my cell. Well, the last night I was there, I had, you know, did my food sample thing. I had 2 little shampoo bottles that I had sterilized because there's a boiling water spigot in there for commissary food, you know, that's like the dehydrated food. And that's actually the water that I would drink. I would fill a container, a milk carton. I didn't have a cup the whole time I was there. This is what I don't understand, Anita. They're making all this money, right? But it's not filtering down to the inmates. I didn't have a spoon while I was there. I had to either eat with my hands or I had to bust off a piece of cardboard off of the container, which was a to-go box. The rest of one of those white styrofoam to-go boxes. You bust off the corner, it makes like a little scoop to eat. So you're basically eating like an animal. You know, I had no container to drink, and you would get, pregnant girls got milk all the time, but if you weren't pregnant, you got milk once in a while. A lot of the times it was expired, I'd throw it out. But I would take the cartons and I would, you know, take them to that boiling faucet and rinse them out, and that would be my cup for the day or for a couple days or whatever. So this last night I'm there, I take some food, I have these sterilized bottles, so I get water from both the spigots, and I got that. I get this real big paint chip, and I wrap it in the plastic, and I got everything there, right? I get up the next morning, and it's all gone. When they call me to release me, they wake you up through the squawk box real loud suddenly, you know, in the middle of the night, and they just say, roll it up. and I'm like, okay, that's the other thing. They talk to you like you know what they're saying. And because a lot of the people in these jails are there over and over again. Why? Because there's no rehabilitation. But, yeah, so they had come into the cell, and I'm guessing that they had done that around 2 a.m. when they woke up my cellmate who was diabetic. Because the diabetics, they wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning to have AccuTech for their blood test, you know, to check their blood sugar. They send them back to the cell, and then at 3 o'clock, they wake them up again, and they have breakfast at 3 o'clock in the morning. Diabetics eat at 3 a.m. They don't eat again until 12 noon. Now, tell me how that makes sense.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so somewhere during that transition, my little samples of stuff that I had put together were gone. So they obviously had come into the cell and grabbed them. They weren't going to let me take them. So, you know, I mean, what are they trying to hide there? I can tell you, everything that I did eat there all tasted the same. There's something universal in everything, other than the fruit, you know, the fresh fruit or the milk when it was okay and not expired. But the food in the tray, whether it was vegetables or some kind of starch or some kind of what they call meat, most of the meat you got there was a soy product. The only other meat you really got outside of the soy product is once in a while this like chicken patty, and then you had a lot of bologna sandwiches or this cotto salami, and those were the multicolored meats. The bologna and the cotto salami was literally green and purple, and it didn't look like meat at all. And, you know, and that's what you're expected to eat this. And, you know, I mean, the people, you're only going to have so much willpower when you're hungry, you know. I mean, you're going to get to the point of hunger where you're going to have to eat whatever it is that's in front of you just to make it through that day. And it's really sad. So, you know, all those things that I wanted to take out are gone. So I do want to follow up with some of that stuff. So there's going to be more about this. This is one of those things where, I just have to look at this like, I am meant to write about this, you know. Interestingly enough, Dylan Avery, for the listeners out there, Dylan Avery of Loose Change, fame, the director, is a friend of mine, and he has a new documentary that he's working on that will be coming out. There's no release date yet. I did get to see a little teaser trailer, and it's going to be amazing. It's called Black and Blue. And it is about police brutality. You know, he's talked with Cop Block, and he's interviewed Alex Salazar, another friend of mine at Renegade Popo, who's an ex-LAPD cop, you know, and others all around the, you know, the country. Alex Salazar was just in Ferguson, you know, dealing with that stuff there. He also dealt with the Andy Lopez case and had some interactions with Cindy Sheehan out in Northern Cal while they were doing that. So Dylan actually is going to interview me. Dylan's going to be looking into some of this stuff as well. And so Dylan will be up here next week. So that would be kind of cool to hang out with Dylan. But it's nice to see that people like Dylan, who were pretty much solely focused on what's going on the outside, is now looking, going, yeah, you know what, this is a bigger problem. It is systemic. We need to not just zero in onto one little finite aspect of this. This is happening with law enforcement everywhere.
Right, right. And it's pretty well known that the whole situation here in Florida is pretty bad. In regards to Florida is one of those states where, you know, they make fun of us in movies and things. Just, you know, I remember watching the movie The Fockers, and they made the biggest joke out of, you know, the cops that were just using tasers on anybody. And I thought, you know, that's not too far from the truth, really. And I, of course, I know people that have been incarcerated that have, you know, their stories to tell about what happened when they were in there. So yeah, it's a situation that's happening. It's happening everywhere in varying degrees. And unless there is, we spoke earlier about Carl Dix, who has that.
Mm-hmm.
Who has that? I'm looking now. I have to look it up because I can't remember. But Stop the Incarceration organization. I'll get it for you in a minute here. I'm just looking it up.
I think it's stopmassincarceration.com.
Yeah, he's the founding member, representative. He's the regular contributor to Revolution newspaper. And he's on Twitter. He was at Ferguson. So he was there basically saying, okay, well, the powers that be had the mouthpieces going. You know, they put the cop there that was willing to work with everybody. They had a couple of other people that were willing to work with everybody to so-called pacify the crowd. Well, no, that's
right.
Not what needs to be done. It was supposed to be, it was very clearly, an uprising. And it
mm-hmm.
very clearly didn't accomplish much because the cop has still not been presented. He's still not
right.
been arrested. Nobody knows where he is. So, you know, that was a failed situation there. And
right.
we're going to have more of those. We're going to have more of that happening across the country, especially as the black community has had enough of being pacified. They're being
right,
pacified.
Right.
I mean, down here in Florida, if they even think that a black man killed a cop, they'll hunt him down like a dog and shoot him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Lynch mob. It is it's stopmassincarceration.org.
Right, right. And Carl Dix is the founding member. So
right.
very, very – he spoke at Ferguson. When you look him up on YouTube, anybody that's listening, you can hear him speak about what exactly happened at Ferguson. And, you know, he's really been an advocate for the prisoners that are just, you know, they're left in these facilities under these conditions that, you know, you've spoken about. And, you know, in varying degrees in different places, but all bad. All different levels of bad, but all bad. So
yeah.
But anyway, yeah, we're getting close
to. I assure you. I was just going to say,
yeah,
I assure you, the things that I witnessed are happening everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And we're getting close to the end of our time, and we were going to talk about maybe just a few other things. We can probably just touch on them briefly. Tell us a little bit about what you thought about in regards to 911 yesterday and the big thing that went on in New York City.
You know, here's what I did. I treated 9/11 yesterday differently than I have every other year. I avoided any media like the plague, except for a little bit of Facebook. I avoided most 9/11 related posts
mm-hmm.
Because right now, Anita, for me, as I said, I just found out I have cancer, and then boom, I'm in jail, and then I'm out. You know, I'm still trying to digest some stuff, and it's been very emotional for me. And 9/11 hits me hard every year, and it's funny because people like you and I, we live and breathe this all the time, and I live 9/11. I have for 13 years now, and. It was the 13-year anniversary of it, but it's just another day to me because every day is a day to remember 9/11. And so what I inevitably ended up doing is I ended up shutting everything down and leaving and going to a comedy show, actually. I had to get away from it because I'm seeing all this stuff where all this rhetoric going on about ISIS and Fox News saying that we were going to be attacked yesterday and, you know, all this crap, and it's like nothing's changing. It's only getting worse.
Right, right. And that's why we need challenging the rhetoric. We need to do that. I mean, that's why that's why telling the truth has become a revolutionary act, basically. It has been.
Right.
And what is your take on all these calls to war? Because it seems like as we've been revved up for 911, if anybody out there has been watching the TV, I did the same as you yesterday. I turned it off.
I had.
I had to for my own sanity. But what do you think about all of the calls for war and how this is, I think this is just conveniently timed for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, the calls for war are going to take us from yet again a president to a new president that's going to carry over that war, first and foremost. A war with Syria is not going to end before the next president comes into office. So we're going to have a passing of the baton there, which means, the new president coming in can do whatever he wants with that war, and, hopefully it's done out of the bush. But, you know, as far as the calls to war go, there was a time early on in my political learning that I didn't understand a lot of things about the bigger picture of the presidency, meaning that the president really is a puppet to something greater. And, you know, of course, over the last decade, I've learned so much and been a part of so many different things that I now can look at these things from a different perspective. And it's like the president, doesn't matter who's in office. When I look back at 9/11 and all the research that I've done on 9/11 and the work that I've done with regards to 9/11 truth is, you know, it all goes back to the Project for the New American Century for me, you know, and that's
right.
The foundation for 9/11. And, you know, in their RAD document, the Rebuilding America's Defenses document, which I have a hard copy of, that I have a hard copy of that, and the National Security Strategy of the United States, and I print all this stuff out and just have it so I can reference it. But in the RAD document, you know, one of the things that they were, you know, of their plan that they were laying out was, quote, unquote, multiple simultaneous theater wars in the Middle East to control resources. Okay, multiple simultaneous theater wars. Okay, we've had Afghanistan and Iraq. Okay, so now we're going to have Syria. You know, it's been a complete destabilization that has taken place over there. Not that it was stable over there to begin with, but we've destabilized it in such a way that as much as they want us out, they need us there. So it's a catch-22, you know, from their perspective, not my perspective, just get the hell out. But, you know, the thing is that what we're seeing is the same language, the same fear, the same they're going to get us. You know, they're ramping up for a war, and what do we got? We got Fox News saying that, you know, it's a potential imminent threat for an attack on the anniversary of 9/11 on the West Coast from ISIS. You know, they're here, they're in the United States. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, you know, I haven't forgotten the language after 9/11. And I'm hoping that the majority of the people in the United States, you know, since we're responsible, that they also haven't forgotten and, if anything, have become more wise and more hip to what's happening. And, you know, there's nothing different happening here, Anita. We're seeing the same plays out of the same playbook, and they are going to take us, you know, into this other war. And, you know, and we're off, you know. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be. And this is going to be passed on to the next president. Now, I'm tired of hearing over the last couple months, I've heard this a lot, that we're out of Iraq. Bullshit. We're not out of Iraq.
No, we never left Iraq.
Exactly. So what are we passing to a new president? Okay, so let's look at this from the perspective of not being wise that there is even an even bigger government and so on and so forth. Let's just take it at face value. This is the president of the United States, right? So we're going to have this new president come in, and we're going to hand him three wars, three ongoing wars.
Yeah.
How does that work? And, you know, we are, our country, our economy, everything is so bad. Everything that's going on right now that's of relevancy to our day-to-day lives really does fall back to 9/11, which falls back to a certain handful of people. And, you know, we are only going to get worse. I don't like to be a doomsayer or whatever and stuff, but I don't see things getting better. I see things getting worse. Will they get better at some point? I don't know. I think that the damage that we've done to our environment, to this planet, is irreparable, irreversible. So, you know, we can go down that road and, like, you know, people can just say, you know, screw it. It don't matter anymore. I'm just going to live my life. I think there are people out there that already have that mentality. So I don't know where this is all going to go. I think it's just going to get worse and worse and worse, though. And that's scary to me. As a single woman, I'm 46 years old. I'm unattached to anybody. My kids are grown and gone. You know, I live by myself. I don't have anybody. I don't have a support structure. I don't have, you know, a comrade to help me through the end of things as we know it here on Earth. So, yeah, it's all pretty scary.
And it's, yeah, I feel that. More than ever, it's really, really, really important to reach out to, you know, your community and let people know that you have a skill, what your skill sets are, Yeah. So everybody can help one another. And Cindy Sheehan had spoken about it. Well, lifeboating. Michael Rupert had spoken about it, and so did Cindy Sheehan. She called it, you know, recreating revolutionary communities and learning those skills that our grandmothers knew.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most important thing. Learn how to prepare food the way our grandmothers did. Learn how to make our own clothes, because it's going to come down to that third world situation that we're going to have. And I think that's a lot closer than people realize, because as soon as gas goes up to like $5 or $6 a gallon, I'm not seeing how a lot of people would even find it possible to commute back and forth to work. It's going to become very problematic for a lot of people. And they're not, you know, just not making enough money to put gas in their cars, you know. So.
You know, I thought that because there was a time, and I don't know what the gas prices were like everywhere else, but back when Bush was president and I lived in Joshua Tree where I had gotten this DUI, full circle now, I worked for the radio station out there, Morongo Basin Broadcasting, and I had to do a lot of driving every day, client to client to client. Gas prices were just a few cents shy of $5 a gallon at that time. And I had thought the same thing. I mean, every day or so, the prices were going up and up and up, where it was so bad that in order to do my job and the other people on the staff, they actually had to give us a gas allowance or we weren't going to be able to work, you know, because I was spending outrageous amounts of gas driving around these small towns all day. And I would like to believe that when we get up to $5 or $6 a gallon, that there's going to be some great awakening. I don't think so. I really don't, because what I'm seeing right now is I'm seeing people that are holding everything so close to their breast because they're, you know, everybody's going to kill them, and you know they're homesteading per se. You know, you can call them preppers, and I'm not saying that the preppers are doing this, but you can call them whatever you want. But there are individuals out there who think that they can do it all, and they're going to just keep on, and that all these things that are happening are still the brown people in the Middle East's fault, not ours. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So it only makes them more angry at this enemy that's not real. And not that I'm saying terrorism isn't real. There are real terrorists out there. There are real terrorist acts. You know, I think that's a big misconception people get when we talk about these sorts of things, like, oh, you don't think there's terrorists? Of course there's terrorists. You know, a lot of them happen to be in the White House, but yeah. You know, that's because every year, Anita, I keep thinking there's going to be this tipping point, this thing that happens, and then the very people that are outside of our choir that we keep hoping to reach, I just see them buckling down tighter.
Well, you know, we'll see what happens. We will see what happens. I don't think it's going to, I don't think it's going to be too long from now, though.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
I know that I'm not going to be able to commute for that amount of gas. I mean, that's where I'm at. I live in the country, so it's really difficult for me to go, you know. One of my jobs is pretty close, and by pretty close, I mean, you know, 15 miles. That's pretty close for me. And the other job is 37 miles. So that's 37 miles one way.
Right.
So that would be pretty tough if I had to pay $5 gas. And what's amazing is I'm working with a family where I'm very good friends with the girl. And I'm working with her father, but, you know, she's already giving me more than I normally would be paid because she knows that the gas even now is a hardship for me.
Right.
So you know, I wouldn't be able to expect her to, you know, to give me more. But a lot of people are going to be faced with this situation. So, but we are getting towards the end. Pardon?
I was just saying that's all going to come back down to every individual's take on humanity. It really is. This is going to be the do or die time. This is where we're going to find out, Anita, who are the real people with heart and who are the greedy son of a bitches who don't care.
Right. It's going to separate the wheat from the chaff. And,
exactly.
And the people that you need to surround yourself with are the ones that are going to work with you in recreating those revolutionary communities and lifeboating and putting all the stuff together in your own community to help one another, or we're all
right.
going to be lost. I mean, that's going to be the most important. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time, so tell me what your future plans are for the next 5 years. And I know it doesn't have anything to do with going to jail.
I hope not, but I will tell you that I've entertained the idea of going back just to get more info. You know, I mean, if these people would have known I was a journalist when they had me in there, and especially where they had me and all the stuff I was seeing and the people I was around, I think they would have got me out of there a lot quicker. I really do believe that. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, are they going to pick on me because of my story? Who knows? I'm really good at SEO, so I know it comes up in search engines.
Right.
And if they got Google alerts and stuff like that, they're going to see it right quick. So I may be in jail. No. My plan really is, I have to tell you, my plan for the last 2 years has been the same, and it's going to continue. I want to keep growing Sherry Speak. I work solely from home. I love it that way. It's very feast or famine for me, very few feasts, lots of famine. When I left corporate media, I had to do that for my own sanity, and I've been out of it for a few years now, and the sacrifices are a little bit different, and the stress is a little bit different, but that's just where I'm at, and that's where I want to stay. Now, that being said, I'm very excited over the Challenging the Rhetoric, and for everybody listening, please check out challengingtherhetoric.com, Anita and I's project that's going to launch on October 1st. I really have a good feeling about this project, Anita. I think that we have the potential with the people you're talking to, the people I'm talking to, plus the people that we're both connected to, of doing something really grand here. And I think having the hook of it being a female entity, you know, happening is also something that's not being really done right now. I mean, we have things like The View or, you know, or The Bite or whatever these things are called, The Two or whatever the other one is, but they're not so much doing what we're doing, you know. I mean, it's not as serious as we're going to be. So that, I think 5 years from now, we're still going to be doing that. But the reality for me, like I said, is I have cancer. They're going to be removing my left kidney here soon. I'm on a waiting list for surgery, and so I don't even have a date for that. I don't know what's going to happen after that. I want to, you know, have positive thoughts and vibes, but for all I know, I won't be here in 5 years. I just don't know. So this next year is all about my health. This next year is doing what I can to get through the surgery and recover. They tell me it's going to be a 3 to 4 month recovery if all goes well. So it's major surgery. And, you know, and hopefully, you know, after this year I can get back to Oregon and be back near my kids and, you know, start doing that stuff. But I've really done a whole 360 in how I look at things. And it is about getting back to the basics, the people that we care about, and doing the things that we care about with those people. And I need to not have everything, every moment of my day wrapped around and saving the world all the time. I need to save Sherry too.
You need to do things that give you bliss and happiness and, you know, our, you know, freedom of expression. And
right.
Of course, I'm sure everybody that's listening, and myself included, you know, we're wishing you good thoughts, sending you white light, whatever you want to call it, saying prayers, burning incense, and wishing and praying for your health. And, you know, it'd be miracles happen every day, and we have to believe that.
Right.
I mean, sometimes they go in and they do the operation, and they put someone under the knife, and they get in there, and the cancer's gone, you know?
Well, I'm taking Rick Simpson oil right now. You know, I've been taking Rick Simpson oil now for, other than the time while I was in jail. Funny story, though, in jail I had a Band-Aid that had a big blob of the cannabis oil on it on a spot on my abdomen, and they didn't get it with their little magic chemical wand. That's ironic. But, no, you're right, Anita. There are things that can be done. You know, I juice. I'm trying to do really healthy things that I should have been doing all along.
But I believe in the cannabis oil. I believe in Rick Simpson and the patients that he's helped. And so I take cannabis oil every day. I take approximately a gram of it a day, and I function just fine. It's not like I'm sitting here like I'm all loaded on weed or anything like that. And I am, am being very positive, and I'm hoping that the imaging before my surgery, they will find that this cancer, that this tumor on my kidney has either altogether disappeared or has at least shrank. Because if it shrank, then I will refuse the surgery. If it has at least shrank, I will refuse surgery. Now, I will lose my benefits if I refuse any treatment because that's the kind of benefits I have. So I'll take that shot. But, we'll have to wait and see until that imaging test comes. So, staying positive and doing those things is all good. Miracles do happen.
Well, we wish you the best, and I want to thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to working with you, and, we'll see what the next year has in store. I'm excited. The people listening out there tonight, you haven't heard the last of us. That's a threat. That's a real
threat. That's a threat for sure.
Yeah, so
they'll say that we're terrorists.
Right. I'm going to close the show with a great song about what we were talking about, but I'm going to dedicate this to the climate march in New York City and for everybody that's going to be there and everybody that's putting it all together. And even the people in the UN that are talking about the climate, I mean, that's a start. Anyway, the song's by Michael Franti, and it's called Hey World, Don't Give Up. So everybody out there that's listening, have a great night. Don't forget to see us on wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com and check out Sherry Speak. That's sherryspeak.com, right?
Yep.
CHERISPEAK.com and check out challengingtherhetoric.com as well. So until 2 weeks from now, next week I will not be broadcasting. I will be in New York City and not sure where, but somewhere. But I'll be coming back the week after that with all kinds of stories from the Climate March. So you all have a great weekend. Thank you again, Sherry, for being on the show. And here's Michael.
Thank you, Anita.
Good night.
Tell me why grass was greener years ago. I swear it used to grow here, but no more. Tell me why on this hill all the birds, they used to come to fly, yeah, come to die, yeah. And tell me why I need to know. Sometimes I wish I didn't have to know. Are we sure? Don't give up on me, I won't give up on you. Just believe in me like I believe in you. Tell me why on the corner all the kids guns here. And tell me why it's okay to kill in the name of the gods we pray. Tell me who said it's okay to die in the name of the lies we say. Tell me why they're child soldiers. Tell me why they close the borders. Tell me how to fight diseases. Tell me now, won't you please? The only thing I want I say, hey world, what you say? should have stuck around for another day. Tell the world what you say. Should have stuck around for another day. Tell the world what you say. Should have stuck around for another day. Too. Don't give up on me. I won't give up. And I try. Don't give up on me. And I cry.